Glad to see you guys again. My name's Aaron, and if you didn't hear me during announcements, I do want to welcome you this morning to Severn Covenant Church. We find ourselves in week 14 of our series through the book of 1 Corinthians. Today, I'm going to be working from chapter 10, verses 1 through 14. And if you're new to our crowd, if you're new to our church family, just to kind of give you an idea of how we feel about the Bible, we don't look at it as a collection of ideas or the keys to success or some things that you could do with your life or some helpful concepts. We believe that the Bible, ultimately, it's a love story. It's written to us and it's written for us, but it's not written about us. The centerpiece of this story is Jesus, and that's why we crack the spine on the Bible, because what Jesus is doing is he is changing people's lives. He's taking people from where they were to where they need to be. And so this morning we're going to see what the old Bible has to say to us, and we're going to work through 1 Corinthians chapter 10, starting in verse 1. I'll go ahead and read, and then we'll get started. Now I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from a spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Jesus. But God was not pleased with most of them, for they were struck down in the wilderness. Now these things became examples for us, so that we will not desire evil things as they did. Don't become idolaters as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and got up to play. Let us not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in a single day, 23,000 people fell dead. Let us not test Christ as some of them did and were destroyed by snakes. Man, I hate snakes. You guys with me? Nor should we complain as some of them did and were killed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as examples, and they were written as a warning to us on whom the ends of the ages have come. So whoever thinks he stands must be careful not to fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to humanity. God is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape, so that you are able to bear it. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. So here what we're getting from Paul, it's kind of a crash course in Israel's history, and he's using this crash course in history as a setup to pastor a very young church that really they find themselves amidst a faith struggle. I mean, they are wrestling with their faith at this point in time. These are people who had said yes to Jesus, but they're having a hard time saying no to everything else. They're having a hard time saying no to all the counterfeit gods that they had trusted in their past, that they had worshipped in the past, counterfeit gods that had enslaved them to sexual immorality and substance abuse and pride and selfishness and all of the things that Paul has been forwardly and frankly addressing throughout this entire letter. You're talking counterfeit gods of money and success, and these gods were their idols. And Paul is writing to people who their big issue is they're struggling to find ultimate fulfillment in Jesus. And ultimately, he's addressing idolatry, right? You guys with me? Idolatry, you're probably like, what? What is he talking about? Idolatry. Because we live in the 21st century, and the backdrop is a lot different for us than it was for them. But Paul is addressing idolatry because idolatry is something that he needs to address in us as well. And the first thing that I'm going to draw out of this text is that idolatry, regardless of what you think, idolatry, it's not an action, it's an attitude. Idolatry is an attitude. It is not an action. Paul's talking about all kinds of things that these people are doing, but at the end of the day, he's addressing the attitude behind the actions. And so Martin Luther grasped this really well, and he commented on the Ten Commandments. And one thing that he noted is that the Ten Commandments, they start with a command against idolatry. And the question is why? Like, why start with that? Why is that the first commandment? And Martin Luther argued that this was the fundamental human problem. This is our fundamental issue. It's the fundamental motivation behind us breaking all of the other commandments. And so why do we fail to love or keep promises or treat people the way that we're supposed to? Like, generically, we might say, well, we're broken and we're riddled with sin and things on this side are hard and life's a train wreck. But the reality is, if we're honest, every time we take advantage of people, it's because we've erected something as the centerpiece of our lives, as the hope of our lives, and we think that if we get that thing, we're going to have ultimate satisfaction. It's us pursuing things outside of God to find ultimate satisfaction. And here's what I mean. Think about this with me for a second. You ever told a lie? Come on. Yeah, you can laugh about your lie in church, whatever. I've told lies, but the bigger question is why? Like, why am I telling a lie? Why tell a lie? What's the motivation behind it? And that's what Paul's trying to help this young church understand. That's what he's trying to help us understand, is the attitude behind a lie. So here's the attitude behind a lie, right? We wouldn't lie unless we had erected our desire for human approval or protection of our own identity or our credibility, or what people believe, what we want people to believe about us. If we didn't resurrect our reputation as more important than our walk with God, then we wouldn't tell lies. We tell lies because we believe that in telling a lie, we're salvaging something that we believe is way more important than telling the truth and walking with God. Because the reality is this, that our actions, what they do is they reveal the attitudes of our heart. And so whoever or whatever is most important to you, whoever you give your time and your money and your passion and your energy to, whoever or whatever that thing is, whoever or whatever gets your love and your devotion and your commitment and your sacrifice, your hopes, your dreams, your fears, to whoever or whatever you're giving that is your counterfeit God. Like, that's what you've put at the center of your life. And you've done it, I've done it, we've all done it. This is a fundamental human issue. And so for some of us, our counterfeit gods, they've done a good job driving us to success in our career, in our ability to network, in our financial kingdom that we've been able to create. Our counterfeit God has given us a degree of success, our morality, our virtue, in a sense. But for some of us, the counterfeit gods in our lives, they've driven us to deep failure and disappointment and depression and anxiety and infidelity in relationships. They've driven us to do all kinds of things. And so to help us understand this concept that idolatry is an attitude and not an action, Paul takes us to the past. He takes us on a journey to the past, because here's the scoop. We can learn from our past. We can glean from our past. But Jesus' plan is not that we live in our past. Jesus is moving us forward as we follow him. Following Jesus is a deliberate, intentional move forward as Jesus moves away from our past. But we can certainly learn things from the roads that we've traveled down in the past. So listen to verse 1. Paul says, "Now I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from a spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But God was not pleased with most of them, for they were struck down in the wilderness." So Paul is taking it way back to Moses and the Israelites wandering around in the wilderness. He's taking us back to Mount Sinai. He's taking us back to that desert place where God's people were for a number of years. And he's talking about a time when God's people experienced God's presence, they benefited from God's provision, and they were protected by God's power. They didn't just see God move, they experienced a degree of relationship with God. God was in their presence, and he showed up as the hero that they had been longing for as slaves in Egypt, being beat down and abused and taken advantage of. God showed up. And what was happening is God's people were literally following him out of a land of prison into a land of promise. They followed him across the Red Sea, out of the lives that they were living, and into the future that God had for them. This is an epic story of rescue, but it's an epic story of struggle. It wasn't easy. It took effort. It wasn't painless. It was painful. And as the people of God experienced pain, their perspective changed. Their attitude changed. The God that they loved and adored became a God that wasn't good enough to them, a God that wasn't able to provide the things that they wanted him to provide, the way that they wanted him to provide them. And in verses 7 through 10, what we find there is that they end up turning their face to their counterfeit gods. They turn their hearts right back to their counterfeit gods. And instead of just having a drink, these people are getting drunk. Instead of just eating, they became gluttons. Instead of chastity before marriage, they're engaging in all kinds of sexual activity outside of the context of marriage. Instead of fidelity in marriage, these people are all over the place. And instead of worshiping God, they're complaining about God. Instead of celebrating God for who he is and what he had done, they were pressing God for what they could get out of him. And the reality was, none of these sins was the core issue. None of what those people did, none of those actions were the core issue. It was the attitude behind the actions that was the core issue, because they engaged in those things because they thought that somehow, they were going to produce a level of security and safety and satisfaction. They were setting their hearts on finding satisfaction in things outside of Jesus. Because idolatry, it's not an action, it's an attitude. And see, when we think about the Israelites, you got to realize, like, the wilderness was not their native land. These were city folk. These were people that grew up in a big urban context. They were part of Egypt. They had experienced commerce. They had experienced a booming economy. They had experienced a richness in resources. They had experienced a degree of political power, in that they were part of a community that really was a centerpiece of the world at that time. Egypt had a very powerful political position. And so going to the wilderness, crossing that Red Sea, and embarking on a journey through the desert was an extreme life change for these people. And so when life got hard and God wasn't delivering the things in their present that Pharaoh had given them in their past, they got fired up. They kind of lost it emotionally. I mean, they're arguing with God and they're complaining. And they start making comparisons about what they had in the past, and measuring their present by what they had in the past. And ultimately, they kind of became these, like, self-appointed experts. Like, the inner expert in them emerged. And I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but kind of all of us have an inner expert, right? Right? You're probably married to one. You probably are one. Your kids are definitely one. They're like, you tell them, you got some, like, cutting-edge parental wisdom. And they're like, I know, Dad. And you're like, how do you know? Like, I didn't even know that. How do you know? Why are we even having this conversation if you know? Right? You with me? Or maybe you're like, you're out with friends and family, and over dinner, some topic comes up, some political issue or a Facebook thread. Maybe you're reminiscing on something you read on Facebook, and your inner expert rises up. You're just provoked. You've got to weigh in. And generally, you keep it subdued and you keep it under wraps, but you've got to weigh in. There's that time when you got to weigh in, and you get rolling, and you're sharing your opinion, and you're going so hard and so fast into your opinion that you lose sight of fact. You can't even distinguish at that point what's factual and what's your opinion, because somehow you've morphed into, like, this beacon of knowledge for the people in your life, right? And your world gets really, really small, and your opinion gets really, really big. And when your opinion gets really, really big, your circle of friends starts to get really, really small. You tracking with me? Yeah. And we get angry, we get uncomfortable when we encounter things that we're not familiar with. We get moody, we get opinionated. And our ability to listen, it as our opinion elevates and inflates, our ability to listen, it shrinks and it gets really, really small. And so here's a question: are you a person with a big opinion or a big purpose? And you can answer that sometime in your life. But are you, because God's people are not called to have big opinions, but they are called to live with big purpose. But some of us, this is where we're at right now. We're in a wilderness. All we feel is pain. We're losing sight of that big purpose that we had when we started following Jesus. We're being challenged by the chaos of a marriage that just isn't going the way that we envisioned it. It's not a happily ever after kind of story. We're being challenged by a career that just never got off the ground, or a dream that just never came to fruition. It's not coming to reality. Or maybe we have a mountain of debt that's like we're looking at it and we're like, I will never be able to climb to the top of that. That's taller than Mount Everest. We're being challenged in our lives. An unexpected diagnosis, a custody battle, a divorce, relational tension. I mean, you name it. Maybe we're single in our 30s. I'm sure we have some of those in our midst. And that doesn't feel good because everybody around you is asking you, why are you single in your 30s? And it's just weird and it's awkward. But it's okay if you're single in your 30s. Yeah, amen. Amen back at you. Or maybe you're childless and you've tried absolutely everything. Like, we're being pressed in. We're in the wilderness. Some of us have an empty nest and we have no idea what we're going to do. We've had those kids around for so long, we have no idea what the next step is for us. And some of us have kids that are so far gone, when we look in the mirror, we just feel like a failure. Because that wasn't the vision that we had for that baby when we held it for the first time. When we locked eyes with it and fell in love with it. We're in a wilderness. We're experiencing unmet expectations and loneliness and anxiety and depression. And when we get out in the wilderness, we lose sight of God's purpose. We easily forget about the things that God has done. And we start reverting to those counterfeit gods. We start clawing for them and looking for them and trying to find things that are going to give us a sense of satisfaction that we need. And we turn to money, we turn to drugs, we turn to sex, we turn to relationships, we turn to our kids, our friends. We turn to all kinds of things that ultimately do not satisfy our souls. But it doesn't have to be this way. It really doesn't have to be this way. Our current circumstances do not have to define our future. God does not want our current circumstance to define our future. We don't have to let our current pain steal the promise of a future that God has for us. We don't have to cling to our counterfeit gods anymore. We can leave Egypt. We can make it out of the wilderness. Listen to what Paul says in verse 6. He says, now these things became examples for us so that we will not desire evil things as they did. Paul is saying, hey, if you take some time and you identify the counterfeit gods in your life, the things that you've erected in your life that you're looking to for ultimate significance and purpose and security and hope, if we can identify those things, we can dismantle them and start following Jesus the way that we were designed to follow Jesus. But here's the most challenging part. It's hard. These things are invisible because they're embedded in our hearts. They're not sitting on the mantle at your house. It's not like you gather around the fireplace and you're like, hey, children, I want to show you the idols of my heart. And you look at them and you interact with them. It's not like that for us. And here's what I mean. I think it'd be easier for us to identify the idols in someone else's life than it is to identify them in our own. Or in another culture than it is to identify them in our own culture. Here's what I mean. When I was in my early 20s, I lived in Central America. I lived in a small rinky-dink town in Guatemala. We were on the eastern coast. And my role there was I helped run an orphanage that primarily took care of kids. We had about 100 kids and loved it. Loved those kids. Loved that environment. Loved the I don't know what's going to happen day-to-day living. Or I don't know where we're going to get the next meal sometimes. I mean, it was like you either believed God or you ran. But I loved that time in my life. It was a great time in my life. Another thing we did is we planted churches. And so we were operating in some really, really remote areas of Guatemala. And you would go into some of these towns and the idols weren't in their hearts, although they were, but they were on a shelf. I mean, they had statues and shrines and little places where people would congregate and burn fires and sacrifice chickens. And the first time I saw I'd never seen that before. So I'm like, Chick-fil-A? Do you guys have a Chick-fil-A? Eat more chicken? They're pouring out whiskey and throwing some tobacco on top of it because they're appealing to an idol. They're worshiping an idol. They've placed their trust and their hope in making that idol happy and pleasing that idol. And it was easy to discern. This is a culture they're highly influenced by idolatry. But what you and I may fail to realize is so is ours. It just looks different. And so a number of years ago, I met a gentleman from Africa, and we got to talking, and he was in the United States. He had immigrated to the U.S., and he was sharing his perspective, and he was commenting on how in Africa, you can see it. You know what the idols are because they're visible. People flock to them. People worship at the foot of that idol or that shrine or that place. They're easy to identify, but he said one of the biggest challenges he saw with America was that they're hard to identify. And generally speaking, people tend to be blind to them. He said in America, people worship idols, but they don't call them idols. And when he elaborated, I'm thinking, what are you talking about? How do you worship an idol, not call it a whatever? So anyways, he elaborated, and what he was suggesting was this. He was suggesting that Americans worship their sports teams and their celebrities and their sex life and their social status and their hobbies, their income, their job, their lot in life, their financial security, their house, their vintage car or their luxury car or the car that they just have that they really like. We're not sure why they like it. They worship their politics. They worship their citizenship. And I was like, man, I can't even disagree with this perspective. And I don't know if you're tracking with me or not, but I couldn't disagree with the things that he was saying. And the reality is we're challenged with being able to easily discern the idolatry in somebody else's life or another culture, but we struggle to identify it in our own. And that is the big challenge. It's kind of like, you remember when Jesus was talking about the speck in your eye? And he was like, hey guys, you're trying to get a speck out of that guy's eye? Like he has a speck. A speck is small. You can't even see it. You ever try to get a speck out of somebody's eye? Every once in a while, my wife has one and she like flares open her eye and she's like, get this speck out of my eye. And I'm like, I don't know if you're going to be blind after this, but I'm going to try. A speck is tiny, it's small, and Jesus says, you're trying to get the speck out of somebody's eye, and you have a lumberyard in yours. Like you got 2x4s and 4x4s and floor joists and roof trusses, the whole 9 yards, and you're bent on trying to get that tiny little speck out of somebody else's eye. And Paul, the reason why he's not addressing attitude or action is because it's our attitude that motivates our action. And if that can change, we can change. And so while traditional idol worship, maybe it's highly visible and we see it, invisible idol worship, it's universal. Everybody's doing it. Listen to what we read in Ezekiel 14:3. It's God, and he's speaking to leaders, the leaders of Israel. These were people who led other people. These were people that we would have looked up to and said, hey, what do I do with my life? And they would have said, hey, stop doing that, do this, follow me, whatever, tithe more, give more, be more generous. These are the people that we would have turned to. And here's what God said. He says, these men have set up their idols in their hearts. God was saying that the human heart can take anything, good things. These are good things. The human heart can take good things that you're supposed to be happy about, successful career, love, material possessions, family, and we can turn them into ultimate things like that. And we look to those things and we think, if I have that, I feel like my life has ultimate meaning. And if I can get what I'm hoping for, then I'll know that my life has ultimate meaning. I'll feel significant and secure. So here we go. Let's make this a little more personal. And I want you to be honest with yourself, but don't tell anybody, at least today or right now. What's your biggest fear? Like, what are you scared of? If you had to answer that question, what would you say? What terrifies you? Is it being alone? Is it losing a relationship that you're currently in? Are you scared that people are going to find out the life that you're really living? Like, are you scared of being vulnerable, being honest? And so you shroud everything in little white lies? Identifying what terrifies you might help you get one step closer to identifying the counterfeit gods in your life. Because sometimes the counterfeit god in our life, the idol in our heart, is the thing that we're most terrified of. The thing that we're scared of losing, scared of becoming, or scared of being. Here's another one. How do you introduce yourself? I think this is a curious one. I recently met somebody, and this person, before even telling me her name, was telling me all about her sexual orientation. And I'm thinking, oh, like, throttle back. I didn't know we were talking about that. I like to start by using my name. Like, hi, I'm Aaron. What's your name? This just blew me away. But the reality is, the way that you introduce yourself is like, it's like you tipping your hand. Because you tend to tell people what you feel is most important out the gate. You want to get it out there in the open. And we know people like this. Some of us are just like this. And we hit people with our resume and the business that we built and the school that we went to and the job that we have. And the list goes on and on. Not only did we do all that, we're the president of the HOA and the commissioner of Little League. And by the way, I just killed it in that 5K or that 10K or that decathlon or whatever the line is that you just did. Right? And you go on and on. And then you start sounding like an infomercial. And you're like, hey, and by the way, if you want to be successful like me, all you have to do is these three simple things. And you're just like, what are you talking about? But the reality is, the way that you introduce yourself could be indicative of the way that you feel about yourself, the things that you yourself places a high value on. Here's another one. What makes you happy? Is it love? Is it relationship? Is it success? Is it pleasure? We tend to think that idols have to be bad things, but idols very easily are the good things that we've turned into ultimate things. What do you complain about? What frustrates you? Is it your spouse? Tell us all the deets. I'm kidding. Is it your kids? Is it your job? Is it your church? Is it your boss? Maybe you're complaining about your family because your family's your counterfeit god. Maybe you're complaining about your job because your career is your counterfeit god. Maybe you're complaining about your boss because your boss is your counterfeit god. You're trying to get something out of all of those things that they cannot deliver, and it's driving you crazy. It's making you frustrated, and it's causing you to complain. You want your kids to obey you. They're not. You're frustrated. You want your spouse to adore you and respect you. He or she is not, and it's driving you crazy. You want your boss to promote you and approve you, and it's not happening, and it's driving you crazy because you're putting so much hope in the counterfeit idols of family, career, human approval. Where do you run for comfort after a hard day? Is it the fridge? Is it substances? Which, if you're going to the fridge and you're eating like lots of chocolate cake, that's a substance, I think, maybe. Where do you go? Where do you run to? Where you run might be indicative of the counterfeit gods in your life. Is it drugs? Is it alcohol? Is it sex? Is it spending? Do you run to your wallet and then you run to the mall? Where you run when you're feeling uncomfortable might show you exactly who your counterfeit God is. I'm not condemning shopping, by the way. Okay? Jeez. Look, here's the truth. Here's the truth, the honest truth. This is me getting real with you. If I'm honest with myself, my life, like it has always been and it always will be to a certain extent, a struggle of faith. And here's what I mean. Sometimes I trust Jesus. Like I trust him a lot. I mean, I could tell you some stories about when I lived in Central America and we were doing nothing other than trusting Jesus, grabbing a steering wheel and hoping for the best. But there are times in my life where I live like he doesn't even exist. Sometimes my identity and my security and my hope, it's completely in him. But there are times when I turn to the counterfeit gods of my past, human approval, success, my job, my financial position, my comfort, my wants, my needs, my desires. I turn to all of those idols. And that's where I'm finding my identity and my security. Sometimes I love God more than anything in the world, and sometimes I love everything in the world more than I love God. Sometimes I worship God just for who he is and the things that he's done, the things that I've seen him do, the things that I had front row seats to, the way that he's changed my life and transformed the way that I think. And at other times, I find myself worshiping God just trying to get something out of him. And I get upset with him when he doesn't deliver the things that I believe that I deserve or the things that I think I've earned. Look, if you're honest with yourself, I think you can relate. I think you can relate. Look, sometimes my soul is facing the God who can satisfy it. And sometimes my soul is facing the counterfeit gods who are only ever going to sabotage it. Which way is your soul facing? Which way is it facing? Is it facing the counterfeit gods of your past? Or is it facing the God who has secured your future? Is it facing the God who can satisfy your soul? Or is it facing the counterfeit God that's only ever going to ask you to sacrifice your soul? Regardless of how you answer that question, I am convinced without a shadow of a doubt that the reason why you and I are still drawing oxygen is because God has something amazing for us to do with our lives. He still has mission. He still has purpose. He still has a plan for our lives, even though most days we find ourselves struggling just to believe that God is who he says he is. We're not called to spend another day clinging to the counterfeit gods of our past. We're not called to die in the desert. We're called to follow Jesus out of the desert so that we can experience our destiny. And the secret to getting through the wilderness, mind you, the Israelites, you know how many made it out of the wilderness? Two. I'm mind blown when I read that. Two. Moses didn't even get out. Two of them. Everyone else died in the wilderness. When the Bible says that God was angry with a lot of them, it meant a lot of them. It wasn't like a majority where he was like, well, I'm mad with 51%, but these 49% I'm really happy with. God was upset because people turned from God and they were clinging on to something that was never going to do what only God could do. Two people made it out of the wilderness. But because of Jesus, more than two are going to be on the other side. Because Jesus is still entering the wilderness of our lives to get us through it, to take us to the promise that he has for us. And so, what Paul is trying to help the Corinthians do is see that Jesus is more satisfying, he's more safe, and he's more secure than any of the counterfeit gods in our lives. And listen to what he says in verse 11. He says, now these things happened to them as examples, and they were written as a warning to us on whom the end of the ages have come. Paul is telling us that the culmination of the past has arrived, and it's arrived in Jesus. And that all that past pain, all that past struggle, it comes to its culmination in Jesus. And all it is, all that pain is, all the pain that we're experiencing today in our lives, all it is preparation for a future promise that Jesus has secured for us. Because our past has been redeemed by Jesus, our present has purpose in Jesus, and our future is secure in Jesus. Because ultimately what Paul is trying to show us is that Jesus is our escape from idolatry. He goes on to say that whoever thinks he stands must be careful not to fall. No temptation has overcome you except what is common to humanity. You're not going through something that's so unique to you that no one else has experienced it, that God doesn't know how to deal with it, that Jesus can't take you out of. God is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape. I know it's hard, church, but hang in there. Jesus is committed to moving us forward. He's committed to getting us through whatever wilderness we are in. He has secured an escape. And he says, he will provide a way of escape so that you were able to bear it. Therefore, my dear friends, free from idolatry. Don't go back to those counterfeit gods. Don't turn back to those things that gave you a sense of security and hope. And you know they only let you down. I guarantee you that every single one of us has at a point in time hoped in someone, and that someone has made you angry. That, my friends, is called being let down by a counterfeit God, FYI. My wife is not called to complete me or make me whole or do anything that she's not called to do that Jesus has said only he is called to do. My kids can't do it, my career can't do it, my accolades can't do it, my success can't do it, and my failure can't keep me from what Jesus has secured for me. Listen to what Paul is talking about in Philippians 3, and if you've never read this like a million times and then tell me you're not excited. But Paul, he understands the power of counterfeit gods, and we can see where he's coming from if we go to Philippians 3. And basically, this is what he's saying. He's saying, all those things that I used to count on, all the things I used to keep track of, the things that gave me security, the things that gave me significance, the things that I had built my life on, my entire life on, the counterfeit gods of success and achievement and social approval, the trophies that I held high in the air to make me feel like I had somehow arrived, like I had somehow made it. All of it is garbage now. Paul is looking at his past and he's saying, okay, all right, all that happened, great. And I'm kind of happy with a lot of it. And maybe that's you. And he's like, and it's garbage. And it's done. It's water under the bridge. It's over. Because Christianity is forward moving. It's not backward looking. He's pushing all of that to the side. And he's saying, all I want is Jesus and what Jesus has for me. I'm so alive in Jesus, my appetite has been completely and utterly changed to the degree that I don't even desire those things of the past. They can't satisfy me the way that Jesus can satisfy me. He wants us to see that all the things we think are so important, the things that we're blowing a gasket over today, all the trophies that we've accumulated can't even compare to knowing Jesus. And look, he's not condemning success. He's not saying, hey, you shouldn't have trophies on yourself. He's addressing the attitude behind it. Jesus completely changed Paul's perspective. He completely changed Paul's attitude. And because of this, Paul is leaving everything behind. That's the good, the bad, and the ugly. All of his success, all of his failure, all of his misconceptions. He's leaving it all and he's moving forward with Jesus. And as the worship team comes up this morning, I want to ask you a question. And the question is this: what are you holding on to? Think about your life right now. Is there anything that you're holding on to that's just holding you back? Are you moving forward in your attitude, in your generosity? Are you moving forward in your faith? Are you moving forward in your marriage, in your relationships, in the way that you treat people that disagree with you? Are you moving forward in your commitment to Jesus and what Jesus is doing to change the entire universe, to change lives, to reach people so that people can have what you have? And that's a transformed life and a secure future and a hope that doesn't go away. Look, understand Paul's heart behind all this. Because he goes on to say in Philippians 3, he says something that's huge, and it shows us his perspective. He says, I'm not saying that I have it all together. And I'm paraphrasing, by the way, in case you didn't pick up on that. He's not saying that he's made it. But I am well on my way. I'm reaching out for Jesus through the hard, grueling process of Christianity. But my strength through it all is not the success of my past. It's that Jesus is holding on to me through all of it. Friends, don't get me wrong. By no means do I count myself an expert in any of this. But I've got my eye on the goal where God is moving us onward in Him, in Jesus. I'm following Jesus and I'm not turning back to the counterfeit gods of my past. Look, Paul, despite the trophies he had on his shelf, despite the accolades, despite the accomplishments, he's saying, church, following Jesus is a process. I haven't made it yet. You haven't made it yet. But Jesus is our escape. Jesus is our escape from the idolatry in our hearts. And here's why. Here's why we don't have to die in the wilderness and why we can experience our destiny of the promised land in Jesus. We have an escape from all the counterfeit gods in our lives, all the things that we've been clinging on to find a deep sense of security and hope and value and significance. Because Jesus, He's our high priest. And He's made a way for us to have intimate access with God. Jesus became our Moses. And He mediated between us and God in a way that Moses could not mediate between us and God. And He led us, He's leading us out of the wilderness. And in leading us, He's not out of touch with our reality. He experienced weakness. He experienced testing. He experienced rejection and ridicule and abuse and emotional turmoil and despair, disappointment and troubles. Jesus was desperate. Jesus experienced success. He can fully relate to us. Towns were clearing out just to hear the man speak. He experienced it all, but He did it perfectly without sinning even once. And eventually, Jesus would turn His face to Jerusalem, His ultimate wilderness, where He would experience ultimate pain and ultimate suffering and ultimate challenge. And we read in Luke 51, verse 9, that when the days drew near for Him to be taken up, He set His face to go to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the place where the real pain and the real agony begins for Jesus. And He's setting His face there and He's moving His feet there, so that He can do something that only He could do. It's where Jesus would lay down His life and pay for the sins, yours, mine, and everybody's, past, present, and future. It's where Jesus made a way for the world to overcome the counterfeit gods of their hearts and have a love relationship with the true God. When Jesus turns His face to Jerusalem, this is Jesus deliberately setting His will on His mission. Jesus is saying, I will not be deterred. Nothing will get in my way. I'm not skipping. I'm not skipping along. I'm not peeking at the past. I am taking steps forward to my future so that you can have a future. He's refusing to hold on to his life as he is, as it is. He's refusing to recount the people that he's reached and the healings that he's performed and the way that he's brought dead people back to life, in the way that he turned water to wine, in the way that he changed the dynamics of some communities, in the way that people followed him like they followed a celebrity. He's refusing to tally the number of people that he's influenced, because Jesus wasn't interested in preserving what he had done. He was interested in accomplishing what he came to do ultimately. Jesus is not interested in preserving our past. He's interested in guaranteeing that we have a future. Jesus knew that if he didn't die, we couldn't live. Unless he laid down his life, we would continue to lay down our lives to counterfeit gods and the idols in our hearts. He knew that unless he made a way out, we would have no way out. Unless he became our escape, we would have no escape. And this wasn't easy for Jesus. He agonized over it. He wrestled with it. He asked his friends to pray with him about it. He prayed about it, and then he went to God with it, and he said, God, is there another way? Can you take this cup from me? And then he responded and he said, not my will, but your will be done. Jesus was abandoning the safety of his life so that we could have life. Jesus was abandoning his own personal security and personal interests so that we could have an escape from idolatry and the counterfeit gods that sabotage our souls, so that our souls could be ultimately satisfied. Amen.